Hello and welcome to the Americano podcast, a series of discussions about American politics, power and prejudices. We are doing a US election special event at the Emanuel Centre in central London on October the 24th. And I almost don't need to do this announcement because tickets are selling so fast, but I want Americano listeners to take advantage of this opportunity and to get themselves a ticket. The special guest, who I wasn't allowed to announce before, is Nigel Farage, the leader of the Reform Party, a friend, I think we can say, of Donald Trump. And so I will be asking him about Trump and about the 2024 election and about the transatlantic relationship that Reform have with the Republican Party. Do come. We'd like to see you. You can book a ticket to this very, very special event at spectator.co.uk/election special. And I would urge you to do that because I'm pretty sure we're going to sell this thing out. I am delighted to be joined today by the great Thomas Frank, who is not the football manager of Brentford FC. He is, in fact, the best, I think, writer on the American left in America and the author of many books, including most famously What's the Matter with Kansas? And most recently, The People Know, which was really a great book about populism. But we were just saying before, you failed, didn't you, Thomas, Tom, to change the way people understand the word populism now?
Yeah, it's very frustrating. And I say that because I just gave a lecture about the subject a week ago to a group of undergraduates in a swing state, by the way, in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. And I'm explaining to them because if you have to understand where the word came from. So I'm explaining to them what happened in the 1890s, events in America in the 1890s. And then I'm explaining academia in the 1950s, these guys who changed the definition of the word. And you can just see their eyes glaze over. They really don't care. I mean, it's very, very difficult to make them care. I think when I was their age and I would hear about the 1890s or whatever the hell it was, right? I would get very interested in it. But that's just because it turns out, Freddie, upon reflection, that's just because I'm a very strange person.
I suppose maybe it's a bit like people, there was a sort of thing where people say, oh, it's a shame that the word gay has been co-opted to mean homosexual because now it used to mean happy. But I mean, populism has just changed meaning, and it's sad for people who care about it.
Right, and I thought, that's right. But it's more than sad. I mean, there's terrible consequences for it, because what they've effectively ruled out by making it this terrible curse word is reform from the bottom up. Right, that's what populism was: reform from led by ordinary people themselves. And instead, reform has to come from this educated elite. It has to come from the people in government and in administration. And by the way, there's a very good hook here if you want to talk about the Democratic Convention, which you and I were both at. In a lot of ways, it was a model of that. I mean, this is how everybody thinks of reform now. Reform has to come from the highly educated people rewriting the economy or whatever the hell, sitting down and very carefully crafting something like Obamacare, this very, enormously complicated piece of legislation. And that's how we understand reform. But the populists, what is so wonderful and refreshing about them, understood it as something completely, they had a completely different model. And that model is basically no longer available to us. We can't really even understand it or think about it. And the result is what you see around you in America. It's a, reform that doesn't reform.
Yeah.
an economy that doesn't serve about 2/3 of the population. And then what do they say? They're like, well, that's just because you haven't adjusted yourself to it, or whatever, But it's the world that we see around us today is the result of that, that we can no longer think of reform that way.
Well, I as you say, I was at that convention too, and it struck me as the least bottom-up political event imaginable.
Exactly. Exactly. Have you been to conventions before? To
I
American
have.
Political
I've been to Republican ones before, but not. I've never been to a Democratic
you
one. Went,
you, were you there? Were you there in 2016?
I was. I was in Cleveland. It was
yeah. Journalistic. So that was an exciting convention, as conventions go. Most conventions are very boring. That one was exciting. Do you remember there were still, that was the one that nominated Donald Trump the first time. There were people there who didn't agree with that. Do you remember that?
Yes.
And several of them actually got to speak.
In the
and
convention
they had
center.
Something resembling an argument with one another. You never see this in an American convention anymore.
Sorry, but the bit you pointed out brilliant in your piece on Le Monde Diplomatique, which I recommend everyone Google, Thomas Frank Le Monde Diplomatique, you describe the calling out process where the states go round and they call
yes.
out the name.
The roll call, yeah, the roll call. And so, and this was, at conventions of the past, this was the climactic moment. They would, you know, they would show it on national television because this is when the actual presidential candidate would be chosen. Now, usually there was more than one candidate. I know this is hard for you to believe. There would be more than one candidate. And there was even a time in our history where they didn't know who the winner was going to be until the vote was actually taken. It was astonishing, I know. but the roll call at this convention, this one that you and I were at in Chicago, it was so formalized and it was so, the choice had already been made, as they told us several times. So the roll call was strictly a ritual. They called it a celebratory roll call vote. And they had a DJ who played records while it was going. And he would encourage the states. He's like, go Wisconsin, or I guess on Wisconsin. Or no, I don't remember what he actually said, but he would play themed records for the different states. Kansas, of course, he played, you know, the band. What is it? You know, that stupid song. It drives me crazy.
What, the band? By the
Carry
band?
Carry on my wayward son.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, that one, yeah.
Oh, I thought you meant the band, which would have been quite good. I think it reminded me of Eurovision. I don't know if you know about Eurovision, the Eurovision Song Contest.
Yes, well, it's widely regarded as the most degraded sort of, pop sort of aspect of pop music.
Yes, and this was like the most degraded political thing I've ever seen because it was a pop music.
Yeah, yeah.
It was just using pop music.
There was no debate. There was not even any difference of opinion, or that I could see. Maybe you had a better seat than me, and you could.
No,
I
didn't see any of that.
It was them explaining their views to us. That's what it was. It was not a group of people coming together and arguing about something. It was a group of people who are in charge explaining their view to us.
Well, what I was particularly struck by was how the people, the activists, the Democrats who they're just showing up. They just seemed so up for going along with it, though. They were enthused.
Yeah. Oh, my God. They were ecstatic. And that was, I think that was because Kamala Harris. So you remember just a few weeks before that, the candidate had been Joe Biden. And there was very little enthusiasm for Joe Biden. And you saw the first debate between him and Donald Trump. And it was a disaster for poor old Joe.
Yes.
And Democrats everywhere were like, my family were texting one another like, oh my God, what's gone wrong with Joe? You know, and then they swap him out. By the way, we still don't really know the mechanism by which he was swapped out and Kamala was took his place.
We think we know,
but it happened. It happened very quickly. And by and large, yes, you're exactly right. Democrats were ecstatic about that change. You know, look, she's intelligent. She's a new generation. She's youthful. Although, isn't it funny? I wake up every day and I say, oh my God, I'm such an old man. She's still older than me. There still has not been a president younger than me, nor is there any prospect of that happening anytime soon. So thank goodness for that. Anyhow, but she's youthful by the standards of the day. Let's put it that way.
Well, yes, I spoke to quite a few people who called her hot. They kept just saying Democrats.
Yeah.
They'd say, oh, she's just so hot. And I thought it was very strange to describe a political candidate.
Oh, well, there is this weird thing going on in America where I really don't want to go down that road, Freddie Gray, but there's a precedent for that. Do you remember Sarah Palin? Do you remember that? There was that whole incident. And then since then, this is particularly noticeable in the Republican Party, where I'm having trouble even thinking of examples, but they go back and forth. They cross the line between elder statesman and hot babe.
Yeah.
and I think they confuse those categories in a way that's not particularly healthy. But they do it for a reason, right? This is.
Yes. Yeah. Well, so let me put this to you, Thomas Frank, that anyone with any populist instincts in their blood is going to be voting for Donald Trump in November.
I'm afraid not, because there's two big reasons for that. I mean, and there's, I'm one of these liberals that will often say that, we're misunderstanding Trump, and there's something legitimate about what he's saying. I think he's, what he said about trade, what he said about, I'm thinking of him in 2016. There, his criticism of the endless wars. There's a lot of what he said that's been very helpful for the system. But he's also a bigot, and there's no getting around that. And there's no way to there's no way that in good conscience I could ever consider voting for a guy like that. Unfortunately for him, that's true for a lot of people. The other thing is his antagonism towards the democratic process. And populists are fanatical about democracy. That is one thing they really, really, really like, is democracy. And we're having a nice conversation here, mocking the Democrats for their for their indifference about democracy. But Donald Trump, I'm afraid, is even further down the. Even further down that path. I mean, in a kind of a frightening way.
Is he, though? Because, I mean, let me put it to you that, the Democrats, they effectively stitch up their own primary process to get Joe Biden in. And then when he clearly just wasn't working, they ejected him. Yeah. We don't quite know exactly how,
yes.
as you say.
By a process still unknown, yes.
By a process still unknown. And then they put Kamala Harris up there, and through a sort of large process of brainwashing, I think, they have tried to convince everyone she is the greatest political phenomenon since Barack Obama. And and they expect the people to just suck it up and go along and vote, even if they don't.
You're just describing ordinary American political propaganda. It's very disheartening. Because the country has, I mean, it's always disheartening because we're a democracy, but it's especially disheartening that this country has real problems and really does need to address them. And once again, we're having an election that's, what would you say in England? It's like get dressed up in costumes and go out and say our lines. It's, it just feels empty. It feels hollow. By the way, and Kamala Harris spams me on my email something like 10 or 15 times a day. And, it's very exciting for a lot of people. You know, I live in Washington, D.C. now, or in the suburbs of Washington, D.C. And this city is just ablaze with excitement about the prospect of Harris winning. They're very, very excited about it.
Yeah. But that may be DC, but I think if you go around the rest of the country, you probably would struggle to find that.
Oh, absolutely. People would share, would be like me. They're just like, they're sort of bored about the whole thing. The only thing that really motivates me is the scaremongering about Trump. And there's an enormous amount of it. You've seen this, Trump is going to be throwing people in jail. He's going to be setting up concentration camps. He's going to be doing terrible things. I'm a scoffer. I've been a scoffer all my life. And I hear stuff like that, and I automatically, the bullshit detector goes off.
Yeah.
And I'm like, that's not going to happen. But then you think about it. What if it does happen? I'm going to feel like a real idiot then. You know, where I'm going to be, Freddie Gray, if that does come to pass, I'm going to show up on your doorstep in London, England, and you're going to have to put me up for the duration until that guy's out of office. I'm going to have to move into the basement of the Spectator or whatever.
We'd be delighted, but I think you'd find British politics is even more depressing.
Yeah, but I don't write about politics anymore. So I also don't.
Well, you're a historian.
But I'm writing a book right now about the history of the idea of creativity and innovation, right? These have become these catchphrases that everyone talks about. So, but I had to go to the conventions. I have to sort of keep my hand in the game, right? Because it's just too exciting. The Democrats were actually really boring. They were boring in a moral sense, I thought. I don't know if you noticed this, but so what, and your listeners are overwhelmingly British, so we'll just describe to them what happens at one of these conventions. They instead of debating the issues, they found other ways to fill the time, and they bring out dozens, probably hundreds of speakers, minor league Democrats from all over America, office holders, aspiring office holders, and they all introduce themselves to the Democratic Party, and the people in the audience are by and large also low-level Democratic officials, and they're learning about who the coming leaders of their party are going to be. All of these speeches are very, very short. They're about 5 minutes long, and they all follow this same pattern. It is a ritual in which the person comes out and boasts about their moral goodness. One after another, and it's their parents were hardworking, were strivers. In the old days, they would say they were born in a log cabin, but nobody says that's in the 19th century. Nobody says that anymore. Instead, they say their parents were strivers. Their parents worked really hard, and then they themselves got really good grades, and they got an opportunity to do whatever the hell it was, and they did it. And oh my God, now here they are before you, and they're just incredibly accomplished people. And the impulse is to compare it to religion, because it's a kind of a ritual, but it's missing something, which is any sense of sin or of shortcoming or of failure or of that you are a damaged person who needs redemption. There's none of that. It is just strictly, and it goes on for days. You were there, Freddie. I this is the first time I ever resolved and then actually carried it through. I sat through the entire convention. I was in that convention center all 4 days, listened to every speech, and it's tiresome beyond belief to just hear about how really, really, really good this category of human known as Democrat is. How incredibly moral and virtuous they are.
I want to say, in the words of J.D. Vance, I'm so sorry you had to go through that, Tom.
He intrigues me. We should talk about him too.
Yes, well, we're in danger of going all over the place. But all right, let's talk about the vice presidential debate in a bit. But can we? Because you also went.
But before we do, I want to mention one. I want to end the story about the moral virtue.
Oh yes, please do.
Which is, and you were there, you saw this, the protesters.
Yes.
So there were all of the Gaza kids showed up. Now the Democrats had been very afraid that the Gaza kids were going to wreck their convention in the manner of 1968. And that didn't come to pass. There weren't enough of them. And, the police outnumbered them at every turn, the Chicago police, who put on a really kind of amazing show of force, including snowplows. I don't know if you saw this, snowplows and helicopters and the streets barricaded. And, there were several different perimeters, right? Anyhow, but I remember coming out of the convention one night after sitting through 4 hours of this, what would you call it? Like this drumbeat of goodness, this drumbeat of moral boasting. And, you know, everywhere I had been treated to 4 hours of people talking about how incredibly good they were. And I came out on the street and you feel the heat immediately. The air conditioning in this place is incredible. You feel the heat immediately, but then also you can hear this voice screaming at you. And it is it was a woman in a Palestinian scarf. What do you call those things? A keffiyeh or whatever. She's sitting right outside the police lines with a big old megaphone, and she is reading the names of children killed in Gaza. And then after about every 10 names, this is what she says it is. I have no way of checking that. And then after about every 10 names, she stops and accuses the Democrats of being murderers and of having blood on their hands. These very people who are coming out of this auditorium where they have been celebrating their incredible moral goodness nonstop for 4 days. And I thought that contrast was kind of shocking, you know?
Yes, I saw that too. And I thought it was very odd, the disconnection between the protests and what was going on inside. But can I ask you quickly about the Republican one? And did you think it was the same drumbeat of moral virtue? Because I thought there was also a religious element there, but that was more to do with Donald Trump surviving the assassination attempt.
Yes. Oh, very much so. Yes. And the Republicans don't go in for that same kind of... I mean, there's, as you know, there's a pretty big cultural difference between the parties, although you wouldn't know it looking at me. I was a Republican when I was a child, when I was young, when I was growing up, and now I'm, you know, some kind of crazy liberal. But the Republicans don't go in for moral boasting. It's more, but they do talk a lot about. And by the way, the Democrats did this time too. They talk about their military exploits a lot more. There's a lot of that. And yes, there's a lot more open God talk, a lot more religious talk than you saw at the Democratic convention. I was going to say a lot more patriotism, but the Democrats actually have reclaimed, and they did this deliberately, by the way. This is one of the sort of refreshing things that they did, was to reclaim the flag as a patriotic symbol. The Democrats have had trouble with that ever since the Vietnam War, but they made a big point of it. You saw at the Democratic convention. I mean, during Harris's speech, they were literally waving the American flags. Anyhow, but Trump, yes, I was there, and this is right after the assassination attempt. So he had a bandage on his ear. He'd been wounded, and just about every speech included at some point in it, thanks to God for sparing Donald Trump's life. And there was also a certain, I mean, they were pretty confident that they were going to win at that point, both because of he had survived an assassination attempt, and also because Joe Biden was still the Democratic candidate at the time. And Biden was, you know, as you know, was way behind in the polls. Trump was way up. And they thought they were absolutely confident at this convention. They thought they had it in the bag.
Did you spot hubris?
Oh, well, so that's... I was about to say that in the very next sentence. And I think that might be their undoing, is they, you know, it was a very well done convention. As these, I'm kind of a connoisseur, right? So are you. You've been to a bunch of them. It was very well done. There were no slip ups. Do you remember in 2016, everything went wrong for the Republicans? Do you remember Ted Cruz's speech in 2016, where they booed him off the stage? He refused to endorse Trump, and his wife had to be escorted out of the floor of the convention. It was crazy. It was anyhow. Nothing like that this time around. Ted Cruz specifically opened his speech with the words, "May God," it was something like this, "May God continue to bless and protect Donald J. Trump." But the hubris factor is after and it was a pretty good buildup, you know, and it was an exciting convention. I thought Kid Rock did a remark. I mean, Kid Rock was amazing. Who's the wrestler? Come on.
Hulk Hogan.
What's his name? He tore it.
Hulk Hogan.
Yeah, Hulk Hogan. Hulk Hogan tore his, rent his garments. You know, he tore his shirt off in homage to Trump. The whole convention is in homage to Trump, who sits there. He sat there in this sort of white throne, this fancy armchair, through the whole thing. You know, we'll get to the hubris in a minute, but you know how in the conventions, the presidential candidate doesn't make their appearance until the last day. You know that. at the Republican one this time around, Trump was there every day. He came out and he would come out. It was like they would stop whatever was going on. And the announcer would say, "Ladies and gentlemen, Donald J. Trump." And he would come out through the tunnel like a sports team or something like that and walk up and very slowly make his way up to his very special chair. And then he would watch the proceedings along with the rest of us. Every speech from that point on would then be addressed to him. The speaker was not speaking to us or to the people on TV. They were speaking to him. And every speaker, and you weren't there, but so you didn't notice this. Every speaker would take these great pains to flatter Donald Trump and to thank God for Trump's presence and this kind of thing. And when they would do that, the cameras would go to Trump. The Jumbotron would go to Trump, and you could see him because he wasn't mic'd up. You could see him accept the praise. He would say, "Thank you," but you couldn't hear him. You just see him move his lips, and so you could. It was a great spectacle. You could watch the person on the stage praising and flattering Trump, and then you could watch Trump accepting the praise in the all on one big screen. Freddie, the triumphs of modern technology. Anyhow, so then, I mean, it's an incredible buildup, right? For 4 days, they build this guy up and everybody's praising him and everybody's talking about how wonderful he is. You have Hulk Hogan, you have Kid Rock, you have some very good speeches from various other people. Trump himself finally comes out, okay? And by this point, I had somehow got a floor pass. So I'm right in front of the podium. And, I was taking pictures and having a good old time. You know, I was talking to delegates and this kind of thing. And Trump proceeded to speak for an hour and a half. I mean, it was like Fidel Castro. It was so boring. You know, after this kind of buildup, you were expecting this guy to really give one hell of a barn burner speech. And instead he goes on for an hour and a half. And he's wandering all over the place. And oh, by the way, you can see the script. It's because it's projected onto a screen at the rear of the auditorium. So that's where Trump himself is reading it from. And anybody sitting there on the floor can turn around and see it. And so you can see where he's ad-libbing. And he's ad-libbing constantly. He's just wandering, you know, blah, 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 blah. You know, on and on and on. These anecdotes that he likes to tell. And after an hour and a half, and I had neglected to wear my compression socks. And so after an hour and a half of this, and you couldn't move, right? The floor was so crammed with people. So it was like a punk rock show back in the old days. You could not move. And after an hour and a half of this, I was like, you know, I need to get out of here. it was like, don't go there if you suffer from claustrophobia, you know. It was that kind of situation. But Kamala, by the way, did the, you know, to her great credit, did the opposite. She delivered her speech in about half an hour. She hit every point. She did it very concisely. And she promised, you were there, she promised everything to everybody in the classic manner.
Then we had the debate, presidential debate, where yeah. Trump was, most objective people agree, pretty awful. Harris was pretty good. And that's probably going to be the last debate that we have. And then, of course, the vice presidential one, in which everybody or most objective people seem to agree that J.D.
And by
Vance...
the way, Trump always performs very badly in these debates. You know, going back to his debates with Hillary Clinton, he's never able to.
I would say he does improve. I think the first one's always very car crash bad, and then it gets better. But we're not going to have another one now.
I thought he did all right in his one with Biden, but that wasn't it wasn't hard, you know. It wasn't tough, but he was easily tricked. Harris tricked him a number of times. By the way, I used to be a debater in high school. This was a really, really, really important part of my life back in the 1980s. And she used a number of classic debate tricks. You make the opponent waste his time with chasing something that's not a real issue. And in this case, in Trump's case, she made fun of him personally in a bunch of ways. And of course he fell for this and wasted all his time responding to these things that nobody really cares about, and that, you know, a real statesman would be like, you know, so what? So you don't think I'm as rich as I am? Like, who cares? But of course, Trump, you know, these things are wounding for him.
Yes,
he's so thin skinned, and he had to respond to every single one, and that was kind of funny. But a lot of the big issues just weren't debated, weren't mentioned, you know, or were very, you know, were discussed only in passing.
Well, yeah. Well, then we had a more substantial debate with the vice presidential one. They didn't mention Ukraine, which I thought was interesting. But apart from that, it was reminded everybody of what political debates used to be like before the age of Trump.
Yeah.
Because it was civil talk. They both had, well, actually, Wolf didn't have that much grasp of detail, but he had a bit more than perhaps Trump showed. And it seemed like a substantial political conversation, and probably as a result, a lot of people who tuned in tuned out.
And the funny thing is that, you know, how I compare everything to high school debate or any of these sort of things. In that case, it was the Republican J.D. Vance who is so clearly, I mean, that's the kind of ideal that we had when I was in high school debate back in the 1980s, was to perform like that guy. That's exactly how you wanted to. I mean, he would have, as we would have said in those days, he won the round easily. I mean, it's not a, he did everything exactly right. The only place where he stumbled was, of course, the price of being on that stage, which is he had to pretend that the 2020 election was still, you know, we don't really know who won, you know, it's kind of a mystery. We're not so sure about that, you know, and the January 6th debacle, which is a, you know, obviously the worst stain on Trump's record. And he had to sort of dismiss that.
Do you think that J.D. Vance is a proper populist voice? Because not a bigot in the sense, I mean, of course, you can find the childless cat ladies clip and so on. But on stage in the vice presidential debate, he was civil. He's a very conservative Christian, but he talked about being pro-family. Do you think he might be a more authentic populist?
He's definitely moving in that direction. So have you read Hillbilly Elegy?
I have.
So I had a book that also came out in 2016 called Listen Liberal that hit a lot of the same themes. And so my book and his book were often paired together at the time. And I was even on at least one TV show with him. We weren't in the studio together. It was like this, right? But and I have no memory of it at all, of talking with him at all, like zero. But anyhow, so I hadn't read Hillbilly Elegy when it came out because I was a busy man. I had things to do, but I finally did go and read it. And then I also watched the movie. It's not a populist book. In fact, it blames the victims. It blames the, so he doesn't, you know, he describes these people that he lives among very, you know, compellingly and everything, but he also makes it clear that he thinks their fate is their own fault. You know, that they have, in some ways, that they have brought this on themselves. And that's even more clear in the movie. And in the movie is, you know, there's this sort of awful deus ex machina in both the book and the movie. It's more so in the movie where you get rescued from this life of, you know, living in a, you know, the poor part of a city in Ohio, you know, in this deindustrialized sort of hell zone of the white working class. And the only way out of that is Yale Law School, you know, which is where J.D. Vance went. And that's close to loathsome is what that is. It's, you know, that's a message that I just, you know, that I absolutely can't stand. Both of those, you know, blaming the people themselves for their situation and then imagining that the only possible salvation for them has to come from some sort of incredible professional success. That's almost Obama-esque is what that is. And he has changed since then, and I think changed in a healthy direction. So his speech at the Republican convention was actually quite good. And in it, he went after the usual. So Donald Trump doesn't use his populist rhetoric anymore. He used to say all kinds of things that I thought were the people needed to hear, and he doesn't really do it anymore. Trump himself is sort of lost in this world of grievance about 2020 and his various sort of hobby horses that, you know, things that he's obsessed with. But he's outsourced that job to Vance, and Vance is not bad at it. Vance is actually quite good, I thought, at the Republican convention. Anyhow, yeah, he hits the trade agreements. You know, he talks about the endless wars, and that's all of that is, you know, is to the good. If only he could forget about Yale Law School. Did you know I almost went to Yale Law School, Freddie Gray? Did you know this? Did I ever tell you this?
I didn't know that. But I would have been in.
I got accepted, and I actually drove all the way out there to New Haven, Connecticut. I was going to go, right, and I would have been in Brett Kavanaugh's class.
Oh, really?
Yeah, but I decided to get a history PhD instead.
I was going to say, you could have been the Democratic or the Republican vice presidential.
Oh, they have so much to answer for. The Clintons, for God's sakes. It's like all of these people came out of there, you know?
Yeah. On the stuff that J.D. Vance gets right or is smart about, as you say, he does seem to be popular with the unions. Waltz was thought to have some sort of union credibility, and that might have been one of the reasons Harris picked him. But the unions, well, as usual, they've sort of come out for the Democrats, but not with the same force as they might have done in the past.
Right.
And if you look at the Teamsters, there was this fascinating response, the online survey of the Teamsters, which is the biggest trade union in the world, I think.
Well, certainly in the United States it is. Or it's either that or it's the second biggest, but it's very large.
Online, their response was overwhelmingly for Trump, 60-something percent for Trump.
You're talking about the rank and file here, the ordinary just members of the union.
Yeah, and so then the actual brotherhood, the leadership
yeah.
of the brotherhood, they came out and said, we're not going to endorse anyone this year, and that was quite funny, isn't it? I mean, they couldn't bring themselves to endorse Donald Trump.
You also saw that their leader spoke at the Republican convention and gave now that was a speech. That was incredible. So this is going to astonish you here, Freddie Gray. I watched that and I'm like, what's this guy doing at the Republican convention? He's saying things that I say. You know, when I go out and say stuff like that in public, they call me a communist. He's saying it to an audience of Republicans. I was just like, my jaw was on the floor when I saw that. That was incredible. But you're okay. So you put your finger on something that is in some ways is beyond politics. And that is this grand sociological shift in America that has been going on for years and is still going and has reached a place where it looks like the two parties are basically trading their social position. You know, when I was a kid, a Teamster was obviously a Democrat. You know, they would endorse Republicans every now and then, but it was always as a kind of a, you know, it was some kind of strategic move or something, you know. They're the only union, or they're one of the only big unions that does that. Some of the construction unions will do things, will endorse Republicans from time to time. But basically Joe Biden, well, let's put it in perspective. As you know, because you and I have talked about this before, for decades the Democrats have been moving away from organized labor. And they've been doing it deliberately. They say that's what they're doing, and then in fact that is what they're doing. They, you know, they theorize about it and they actually do it. And the, you know, NAFTA is the great example. It was a trade agreement that the unions implored the Democrats not to do. They said this is going to hurt us really badly. The Democrats proceeded to do it anyways, and yes, it did hurt the unions really badly. And then the Democrats not only did they do that, then they passed a whole bunch of other trade agreements. This is when Bill Clinton was president, but Obama was in favor of these as well, as were the Republicans. This was the consensus of that period, and the unions were just left out of it. They had nowhere to go. So they're you know, over the years, and then the Republicans, meanwhile, are reaching out to working class people with various other issues, mainly the culture war issues, a lot of the Trump sort of stuff. And this shift starts to happen of working class voters moving to the Republican Party. And at the same time, your highly educated Yale Law School types moving to the Democrats. You know, a long time ago, you know, I grew up in this very wealthy neighborhood of Kansas City. The Franks were not wealthy, but I lived among them, right? And I knew these people really well, went to school with their kids, right? They were These were Republicans, Freddie Gray. That is what that's what the word meant. They owned the place and they were Republicans. Today, I was in that house, that same house for the election of 2020. I went back there to be with my elderly father for 2020. And every precinct in the neighborhood went for Biden, for the Democrat. And that is what is happening in America. These enormous sociological shifts that are going on. And Joe Biden, this is one of the things that makes Biden's presidency really interesting. Biden saw this and actually tried to do something about it. And he reached out to unions in this huge way. He did, you know, he did all of these favors for organized labor, including the Teamsters. He bailed out their pension fund, which is a huge favor. The most pro-labor president we've seen in this country probably since like Lyndon Johnson or something like that. He started enforcing antitrust again. He did all of these what I would call neo-Rooseveltian things. He tried to, I mean, he really did try to put the Democratic Party back on its former track. This is why I like the guy. You know, I think his on foreign policy, whew, you know, kind of a disaster here. but these are all things that I strongly approved of and I really liked about Joe Biden. And I think though that it was probably beyond his power to actually reverse these sort of grand sociological trends. And certainly Kamala Harris is not interested in following and in continuing down that path. I mean, there's the number of Democrats in politics today who can, you know, remember the heyday of the New Deal and the Great Society and, you know, the 1960s. It's got to be fewer than five, you know, and Biden was one of them. Bernie Sanders is one. You know, there's only a few. Elizabeth Warren, probably. But it seems unlikely that another Democrat will try to do what Biden has done. Anyhow, those Teamsters polls, the Teamsters actually liked Biden. He did them great favors, you know, huge favors, but Biden's not the candidate anymore.
Yeah.
And, you know, and so that's the explanation for it. And it's, you know, what can I say? The Democrats ran the most pro-labor. You were there. They ran the most pro-labor convention I've ever seen from a Democratic Party. Cause I don't remember, the 1960s. I wasn't going to conventions back then. The most pro-labor convention I've ever seen them do, including, and they had a great speech from a union leader, in this case, a guy, the leader of the United Auto Workers, whose name is Sean Fain. I always wonder if, isn't, you know, what a name. Anyhow, you might say born to be a labor leader, but you know, the interesting thing is that the union vote is up for grabs and the Democrats have finally realized that they're losing this demographic, this sort of key demographic, and they're fighting hard to try to win, you know, to not lose, and we shall see what happens. These sociological trends have been going for a long time and I don't see them changing course.
Well, yes, because we had Barry Lynn on, who I think you introduced me to very kindly in your house where you're probably sitting. And he was talking about antitrust and he was, I think, trying to be as optimistic as he could about how Kamala Harris might be good on antitrust.
You know, if she continues down this path, the thing is, you look at who's advising Kamala Harris. And I mean, we're just guessing at this point. This is just. We have no way of knowing. She wasn't asked about that at the debate. I doubt any interviewers are going to ask her about that. And if they did, you know what she'd say? Well, I was raised in the middle class, Freddie. And she has this very charming way of dodging questions, you know. But we're just guessing at this point. And I'm all, you know me, I'm a born pessimist. And so maybe I'm wrong, but I suspect that the Obama corporate Democrats will be back in charge.
Yes.
If Harris wins.
Yes, I think you're probably right about that. Tom, I'm going to ask you to wrap up. I'm going to ask you to, I'm sorry to do this, but I'm going to ask you just from your gut, because I think your gut is a better political indicator.
You're going to ask me who's going to win?
I'm afraid so, yeah. Just from your gut.
I have no idea, Freddie. I have no idea. At the time of the Republican convention, I thought Trump had it in the bag. It was obvious. At the time of the Democratic convention, I thought Kamala had it in the bag because there was this the enthusiasm in that hall. I had never seen anything like it. You know, waving the American flag and the outreach to organized labor. I thought they're doing it right. You know, they're playing the chess game, and the whole move to replace Biden with Kamala was a pretty good chess move also. And so it finally looks like these people are playing the game. But at this point, I just don't know. I mean, you look at Trump and his speeches are meandering. You know, they're often disconnected from reality. You don't see how he is a serious contender for the office, but he is. Well, I mean, we know why, because people remember when he was president and the economy was running very hot. It was, you know, for a lot of people, it was a good time. That we haven't even started with the problems with Joe Biden's, you know, the inflation has just, I remember the 1970s, inflation killed Gerald Ford's presidency and it killed Jimmy Carter's as well. And it's, you know, and if Harris loses, it will have done the same thing to Joe Biden. And then there's absolute explosion in illegal immigration is a huge issue for a lot of people. And it's, you know, for lots of Americans, it's actually something that affects them in their everyday lives. And so these are, you know, these are the issues. And this is why Trump is still in contention. I mean, it is, you know, it's surprising to me. He's going up against someone who's much younger than him, who's very accomplished, and who's good at the political game. And he's none of those things. And yet he still has a very good chance. So, I mean, some polls show him up in Pennsylvania. I was just in Pittsburgh the other day. Everybody is, that's all they talk about is politics. And at this point, Trump is no longer what he was in 2016. In 2016, he was kind of a, you know, mad prophet. Remember, he said things that, by the way, this is a lot more than you bargained for. And I'm sorry, you just wanted me to say one word.
No, I much prefer this non-answer. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you remember in 2016, it was he himself was sort of was making things into issues that hadn't been issues before. And that's not the case this time around. But he is still this figure on whom people have pinned their hopes. He's a symbol, is what it is. He's a symbol. So Vance is the character in this election who fascinates me, because he's going to be around for the rest of our lives, you know. And he's after his performance in that debate the other day, you can clearly see this guy is he's marked for the presidency. He will be running next time around for sure.
Probably for the long term of J.D. Vance, losing the election would be good for his career, or better than being vice president to Trump in a second term.
Yeah, I kept wanting Waltz to ask. He did eventually, but it should have been the first words out of his mouth. Where's Mike Pence? What happened to Mike? Where'd he go? Why isn't he here?
Tom, it's been an absolute pleasure to have you on Americano. I do hope we'll get you on again. Thank you very much for coming back. Thank you very much for listening to that episode of Americano. If you enjoyed it, please subscribe. And if you really enjoyed it, please leave us a star rating, preferably 5 stars, and a review.